And welcome back to The Learning Man. On today's episode, we're going to be speaking to Yvonne Denishevsky. Yvonne is the president of the National Esports Federation of Ukraine. And unfortunately, since the start of the war, he has not been able to set foot back on his home soil. He has done an amazing amount of philanthropy to give back to those that are still fighting the war over in Ukraine. We talk about loneliness, we talk about mental health, and most importantly, we talk about vulnerability as men. You're not going to want to miss this one. This is The Learning Man. And welcome back to The Learning Man. I'm super excited. We are here at South by Southwest. And I am super excited to introduce you to the next guest. On this particular episode, we have Mr. Yvonne Danishevsky.
V-S-K-Y.
Danishevsky.
Yvonne. Hello, my name is Yvonne Danishevsky. That's how you name it. You wanted me to start in a Russian accent a little, yes?
Yeah.
Ukrainian, what you want to call it. My name is Yvonne. I come from Ukraine. My first time in Texas, by the way. I'm actually trying my best to do this accent, but as I mentioned, it kind of gets a bit more attention when you go to stage and everybody's like, oh, another person speaking regular American, right. English, whatever, and then you go like, hello everyone, my name is Yvonne, and they're like, wow, hello everyone, and it's kind of easier to wake up everybody up
right, yeah,
with,
sure.
With a bit of Ukrainian accent. I come here to bring some news, hello. Which is hard for me. I never actually did this. But like I've said, people got much more attentive when you speak like this.
Yeah, for sure, man. I mean, it's a hell of an accent, too.
Yeah,
he's like, you have my attention. So Yvonne is visiting us from the Ukraine, right?
Yeah, and
initially.
I've been visiting the world from the Ukraine for over a year now since I've left Ukraine, sadly.
Yeah. Yeah, and
move around.
And he's been all over the world. He's the president of the Esports League in Ukraine.
Not league, the National Federation.
The National Federation, yeah, yeah. For Esports.
All the leagues, I would say.
Yeah, all the leagues.
Yeah.
So he's a huge deal. But he's actually had to overcome a lot of different hardships and stuff to get to where he is. He was one of the number three guy in Ukraine to have internet, which is crazy.
Kinda, yeah.
How did that even happen?
Yeah, obviously not by my means. So the neighbor of mine, he was one of the first importers of PCs to the country, and he was not aware. So I was reading a lot of books. I was one of the first people to actually start proper English education, I would say, educating myself. I was looking for books and stuff about computers, and that is how I've gotten into it. I was very excited and hoping that I would someday have it. And weirdly, happily, one of my neighbors in the same house that I lived in, he was this guy who imported first PCs. Mm-hmm. And so I convinced him to actually go and try out looking for internet, because I've heard there is internet out there already, but it was not there in Ukraine at all. And I'm not the third in Ukraine. I'm the third in my city. So it was not the capital, but it's still a pretty big one, bigger than Austin.
Yeah.
Pretty big one. And yeah, so we did find opportunities. He did find money and means. We actually got an acquaintance to the first internet service provider in the city, which was coincidentally the largest aluminum factory in the city. It was the largest, you know, enterprise in the whole city. So they were the first to get the internet, and they were providing it to us. So this is how we ended up having some. And that was very early back in the days. It was 93-ish.
Yeah.
And I remember, so all the domain names were free. I had like tens of domain names to my name. All my nicknames, Yvonne.com, right like this.
That's cool.
And yeah, because it was post-payment. Right now you have to prepay a couple of bucks for the domain. Right. Back in the days it was all free because there was the list of all the internet websites and it was like 200. All of them. And that was fun times. So downloading a music track would take you 10 days.
Oh my god.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. ICQ was the first messenger out there. I think it was 96-ish. So when I registered ICQ, it was 5 digits. It started with 5 digits. Everybody else in just a year had 9, 10 digits of the numbers. And everybody's like, wow, you have such a short number. Probably you're a very old internet user. And I am, even years before that. There was a very, very, very good time. Interesting to explain. And I wonder how it gotten me to where I am.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. It's so like, I mean, and then so when did you start getting into, because you used to stream and you used to compete professionally in gaming, correct? What games did you compete in?
There was not a huge choice, I would say, just a handful of games. Warcraft, StarCraft, a bit of Diablo, which was not competitive. It was cooperative, I think. Maybe... Yeah, Half-Life, which then went to being the Counter-Strike, still number kind of one game by popularity. So it was something like that. Quake 2 was my, I would say, first big achievement. My first money prize was in Quake 2. This is worth mentioning, I think. 90-something 6.
How much was that winning?
Oh, that was a lot. I think around $3.
Oh wow!
But yeah, in Ukraine you can do something with that. But then my actual first money just got me to remember that there was I think I was 13 years old or so, which is 98, and a person came over from States and to my city, which again is not capital, and he was black, and at that time it was the only black person in Ukraine, I think, out of 40 million people. Wow. And he was just roaming around the streets and everybody was just scared of him. And I approached him and I said, hello. He said, like, I never believed that I would meet somebody who speaks English. And he had a translator with him, but he was out for the weekend. So he just roamed around streets alone. And I said, what are you doing? How can I help? And I reached out to him. We went to a restaurant. I helped him find whatever he wanted to find. And he just tipped me $100, which was my mom's salary for 3 months. And that was my first ever largest money that I've earned. And I said, I thought
like, I am fucking rich.
Yay. I probably bought a very early cell phone back in the days when nobody had that. And I had a cell phone.
So what year was that? That was
98.
That was like 98.
Yeah.
So you were
13 something. Yeah.
Yeah. $100 to a 13-year-old here in the States is a lot of money. I mean, and here you are in Ukraine. Yeah,
but imagine, that guy was very lost, so I helped him out. He kind of gotten safe when he was in danger.
Do you still keep in contact with him at all? Or
No.
So
By the way, I still do keep a lot of contacts with people that I've met in chats and ICQs back in end of 90s, so more than 20 years.
That's
and
amazing.
With some of them, we've yet... get to be acquainted offline. We've never met each other, but we're still texting.
Wow.
20 plus years. One of the friends is in Toronto, so I was thinking of getting there. But me, as a Ukrainian, I still have to overcome a lot of visa problems, so we have a lot of visas, and I've applied for a visa to Canada 4 years ago, getting into pandemic and so on, so I haven't had an ability, but I will probably come, and that will be a pretty big reveal, since
that's
we
incredible.
Even had businesses together with a person.
That's wild. That is wild. Okay, so you talk about, so you learned English at a very young age. I mean, so I and what I understand is you actually speak four languages, correct? So
speak. Obviously, I do have two, like they say, mother tongues, right? I do have I do speak English and Ukrainian, Russian and Ukrainian fluently, but then afterwards I studied German in school and then English in school. Never had to use much German, but I used to know it a bit better. But then due to all the tech and stuff and traveling, obviously English has gotten more important.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I mean, you speak great. I mean, that's why I wanted to have you. I know you were a little nervous coming up on the pod because, you know, you're worried about it, but you could fit in anywhere, man.
The thing is that the way I speak in Russian, for example, is so much better. You know, I use a lot of technical, like, high-level language words, right, which I'm lacking in English, especially in subjects like medicine or something that I just don't know anything about.
Right.
So my day-to-day speech, ordering coffee is very easy for me. But, you know, but a podcast, if it's about esports or learning, man, it should be easy for me since I'm learning.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Okay, so, and talking about, like, world travel, I mean, you would understand.
I've had more than 1,000 flights in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
I've had 600 flights within 1 year.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I was actually collecting boarding passes out of that time, and that was more than a flight per day, sometimes three flights a day and so on. I did a lot of speech. That was blockchain times. I was very kind of prominent engineer in the blockchain things, and I was weirdly against it. So I never did any ICO scams and so on. So I was consulting, advising on how to not burn down.
Right.
Yeah, and so on. So I was flying a lot. I still fly a lot, but the pandemic saved me out. I think I would have died in a plane. It hurt so very much in terms of health and stuff. Mm-hmm. So it was good for me that actually there were no means of flying for 2 years or so.
Right.
And I just started because of the Ukrainian situation. I was in Ukraine till summer. I did a lot of charity work, helping out a lot of funds and so on. But then everything got destroyed, work, blah, blah, blah. So I had to move out, and I moved to everywhere a bit. I traveled, what's it in miles? 40,000 miles in a couple of months around Europe. Wow. Looking for, I don't know what that was, what I was looking for. Revelation, something to stick to. So I stopped flying. I started traveling by car. That was actually a long time dream. I'd never found time for that, to travel around Europe in car.
Right.
And I've been everywhere now. I ended up being in London area. So, and yeah, I just started getting back to what I would say okay-ish kind of life in January. So just right. 2-3 months ago.
Right.
And then flying again.
Would you be classified as a refugee, or?
I kind of am. It's a semi-refugee status, so we're not kind of refugees. Ukraine is a bit unique compared to that, because I think you currently is around 7 million people that were forced to get out of the country were safer that way, and that's a lot. So most of the European countries created they call it temporary protection program. So it's not a refugee status, it's a temporal residence, which we do have in most of the countries. And UK gave it to us too. So this is what I'm using to live right now there.
Okay.
Yeah, and my last trip is still happening for 5 weeks now straight.
Wow.
Yeah, so I left early February. And still traveling, flying every couple of days. I've had this best experience you wanted me to share, which was, so all of my previous travels were usually China, London, New York, New York, London, China, something like that. And this is the first time that I've actually been to Bangkok, Singapore, Jakarta, coming here to San Francisco area. My first time traveling over Japan. And this is, you've never experienced that in your life, I think, because this is, I've even got messed up with my friends because I thought that I'm coming to San Francisco on 8th of March, and he was, you know, getting to meet me up at the airport and so on. And I wrote to him and I said, hey, I'm coming over. It's 7th of March, 5 in the morning or so. I'm going to the airport. So I'm flying for a day or so. So meet me up in San Francisco, 8th of March, 9 in the morning.
Yeah.
He said, okay, but in a day he's like, okay. I'm like, why was he asking? And then again, first time, out of 1,000 flights, that was the first time I've heard that, when every time a flight crew were announcing something, they were like, 6 a.m. in the morning, 7th of March. I'm like, why do they keep saying that? And then when I arrived to Tokyo, he said that it is still 7th of March with your connection. I'm like, okay, 7th of March, Tokyo. It was 6 in the morning, so it should be fine. And then we were leaving Tokyo. She said 7th of March. And then she's like, we're expecting to be arriving in San Francisco 9 a.m. in the morning, 7th of March. I'm like, something's wrong now. It's been 20 hours I'm flying, and it's 9 a.m. in the morning, 7th of March. Then I have internet in the plane, and I'm like, hey, Mark, my friend in SF, I'm already in the plane to San Francisco, and it seems like I'm coming in 7th of March. He's like, yeah, I thought so. I was wondering why, because he said that you've messaged me that you're coming over in a day, and it was 6th, but so you would have either lost 7th of March. I'm like, no, I didn't lose 7th of March. It's 50 hours long.
I've been stuck in the 7th
15
of
hours. Yeah, the, how do you call it? Groundhog Day?
Groundhog Day.
Yeah, it was all day 7th of March. And I did a lot of stuff. I flew for 22 or so hours. I visited Japan, and it was still 7th of March, and I'm in SF, and all 7th of March is still available to me. It was 9 in the morning. And by the way, it was, again, I think my first time in the States when I got detained in this secondary screening thingy. Uh-huh. It was weird. And it was kind of fast. It was easy just because I don't have any return ticket, and they say this is a red flag. I had to spend 3 hours there. Good thing that I had all day ahead of me. Same. Yeah, but it was an interesting experience. And they even Googled something about me. They also did some research. And then she said, yeah, you're just very unordinary, not somebody like trying to, you know,
right.
get a green card. I'm like, I'm against it. I didn't want to. I was applying to this outstanding personality visa for the U.S. a couple of years ago. And I actually stopped because I don't want to live in the U.S. And they were like, oh, you're trying to stay. You don't have any ticket, the return ticket. I said that, first of all, I don't have a place to return to. I want to go home all the time. That is why I'm actually not buying tickets, because I still believe that there will be a way to go back home, which is not going to happen in the nearest future, sadly. But yeah.
Is it possible? I mean, I've been keeping up with, you know,
a couple of years, but I think no, especially flights. I'm not sure. It's not going to happen in the nearest couple of years. Even when the war will kind of, I don't know, will it ever end? It kind of needs to collapse. It needs to end accidentally, I think. I'm not sure it's winnable or anything. It's a very hard topic, but flights were not going to resume in the near future because most of the largest airports, they were destroyed. The most of them.
That is.
So even when the situation changes, you'll have to recover, rebuild, restore everything, everything.
Right. So
it will take at least a year.
Okay. So when you heard that the war was starting, when you heard,
I actually
that,
the bombing, the first bombing was 1 kilometer from me, less than a mile.
Oh, really?
So I heard by the windows shaking.
What was that like? Could you feel the impact of?
Yeah.
So you were there. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you got stuck outside of Ukraine just because of the war.
No, it was.
Okay.
So gotcha. We actually evacuated under missiles. How do you?
Missile.
Yeah.
I mean,
it is, again.
It depends on what part of the country.
Being
you're
the
in.
UK, yeah, it's also very different. Yeah, I have to adapt. Yeah. We've seen them. We've seen missiles, tanks, and everything while going out. And still, so a couple of weeks before the war started and the attack happened, we already knew that I'm living in Kiev, which is the capital. We already knew that the how do you call it, the gold reserve?
Right.
Is it the gold reserve, right? They moved it from Kiev to another city.
That's not a good sign.
And we knew that something is wrong. And
right.
I'm kind of connected to the government and everything, so I knew what's happening, where they moving, what they considered the safer spot. So just when bombing started, we'd move to that city.
Right.
It was 5 in the morning. We already had everything packed up, and I grabbed my
mom.
Yeah. The closest of everyone.
Mom, pack your bags. We gotta go.
I called, texted everyone, and we just got. Yeah. We just went to that. It's on the west. Yeah, closer to Poland
mm-hmm.
and European Union. Yeah, and that was the last time I've been home. So more than a year now I've been home.
Wow.
I was in Ukraine for a couple of more months, but on that safer part. We did a lot of preparation. I did a lot of charity work. That was like everything, you know. I spent and donated it and a lot of money, and I'm kind of, it's in millions. And we were lacking armor. We were lacking stuff for people going to the actual front lines. So we started gathering things. And so you understand it by numbers. Ukraine at the beginning of the war had around 70,000 active military. And straight next day, it was more than 300,000, just because everybody applied, everybody was called to, and so on and so on.
Call to arms, man.
Utility wise, 230,000 people were lacking everything. No arms, no vests, nothing. And we started doing that, trying to get as much as we can. So I did this Re-Ukraine. It was called the Fund Re-Ukraine. We did this research on which vests were better, how to get them into the country, how to buy them by find funds, and they're pretty expensive. And weirdly, I've gotten to be one of the best, never thought of that, professionals in terms of the ballistic quality of vests. So I opened up the production of the, what's the word for that? So you have the plate, and the actual vest, which is kind of not an armored vest if you don't have the plate.
Right.
So we did this t-shirt that will fit in the plate. We did that, and I opened a bunch of productions in Ukraine. And we were looking for plates, which were ceramic or metal or anything. We would try doing the production. It was super interesting. And a lot of people tried faking different types of metal being, you know, able to protect against some different types of ammo, but they weren't. So we opened this research facility, the ballistic checkout center, done by me. Who would have thought? Like I've said, these types of experiences are very weird. But if you're trying hard, if you're, you know, approaching everything you do in the best way possible, in the end, you will have the best ballistic center or the best, you know, shawarma kiosk, whatever you're trying to do. So we had that for a couple of months. Everybody was consulting with us. Everybody was sending their products or potential vests to us for testing. Mm-hmm. We were buying and gathering professional men for hire, I would say. I don't know the word. People from other countries serving militaries, trying and helping us with the armor, with the arms, with the ammo.
Like consultants.
Yeah, they came over, they helped, they brought different types of things that we were trying to recreate in Ukraine and so on. Also imported a lot of metal from Sweden, blah, blah, blah. So I know everything about ammos and vests and how it's done in the way and so on. And I did a lot of educational stuff for people to not provide lesser class of armor to military, mm-hmm. and convince them that this is a better one just because it is worse. A lot of people said that having a NIJ third class of armor is better than having nothing. And I said, like, at least don't explain it. Don't make them feel safe in this, because the war is happening with different type of ammo, which is kind of in the governmental standard, it's called 7H10. This is the armor penetrating type of an ammo. So if you're wearing a vest that does not stop that bullet and you think it does, that's a kind of a bad way of, you know, mentality that it will have during the act. So we tried to convince everybody to test it out, tried to tell them what to expect, how to explain to the military what they're wearing and what to expect from it, right? So blah, 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 a lot of weird stuff. And in the end, definitely it hurt mentally so very much because, you know, started losing friends, family, the people that we worked with, we sent those stuff to. I ended up, the word for that is adopting, but obviously not officially, a lot of friends' children that lost their parents and so on. So I'm supporting a lot of families right now. I moved a lot of them from Ukraine to other countries. I don't have children of my own, but I'm very well experienced in parenting now. Thanks, quote unquote, to the war. But yeah, it's kind of weird.
Thanks, Vlad.
Yeah.
So, okay. So What is it? I mean, and the vests, I mean, those vests, I mean, they're saving lives, right? But that is not your primary, that's not your primary calling, right? That's not your primary job. That is not connected in any way of what you do and what you're, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm an IT engineer. I played games.
Exactly. And it was something that you had to do.
Yeah, it's just about research.
You saw the need for that. That your country needed, and
explains how to approach
that. And you took that job on.
Yeah, I had to because nobody else actually did that. And we contacted a lot of governments. I actually did. My friend, close friend, he had a bunch of small private planes, so he was a part of this private pilot community within Europe, and they helped us out. We obviously, Ukraine skies closed for more than a year now, so they were not able to, but we had a small Suchava, then that's the name of the airport, they're close to the border from the Romanian side. So a lot of people having a small plane, friends of my friend, they did fly around Europe, gather up vests and plates, deliver them to Suchava, and then we pick it up from there, get to Ukraine, to our ballistic facility, try them out, gather stuff, and then they go out, say, hey, this fits, let's try and bargain a proper deal to get whatever the amount of vests you have, because obviously we needed tens of thousands. Nobody could provide that. Nobody had that in stock, and so on. And this actually gotten me being very sad about how things work out in our world, sadly, because everybody is so unorganized. Even people that are trying to think over and do good things and help out, they just don't know how, right? So they get things falling out of their hands, just so much promises in terms of, that is why I kind of am scared of all that support that countries are giving, just because, you know, giving $1 billion will not defend anything. You have to have a proper team that will be well prepared to spending that in a very efficient way, because otherwise you're just going to burn it, steal it, I don't know, lose it, and so on and so on. And this is what I've faced and had to pass with, because a lot of funds actually supported us, but all of that was impossible to do because... Sadly, we as the world are lacking professional, I would not say professionals, but this type of professional approach when you're not even acquainted with this at all, but you're actually trying your best to understand, to do it properly, and to not, I don't know, fucking kill people at war that are your friends with being unprepared, being too amateur about things that you do. This is bad. And a lot of people, they tend to do the express way instead of the professional way. Sometimes you actually have to, because, right, obviously, first day of war, you're willing to do everything because you believe if you put all the power that you have, you can probably win over today. But when it's dragging out for years now, it is a very, very different approach. Mm-hmm. And that change made me go into a very, very big, they call it BDS, big depression syndrome, which led me to a very poor kind of living. So I think I'm going to be into mental health startups this year a bit.
How did you overcome, is that something that you're struggling currently right now because of the war? Are you struggling from depression currently, or are you medicated?
Medication is the only thing that helped. I went to Switzerland for the LSD treatment, and it helped.
The LSD treatment?
Mm-hmm.
That's significant.
Pretty big research happening there about microdosing and stuff, and it helped a lot.
What does that do? It just kind of rewires synapses and...
It's a non-intrusive antidepressant if taken in very small amounts. And it helped. Yeah, I finally got into hear music, I would say. I lost it. So it was, the world was gray, zero will to get up, nothing happened, zero attention, and so on. So this is a very, very, very bad state. And again, hard to explain. Nobody helps. And again, it gets even worse just because you've spent half a year of your life trying to give everything, provide everything, and you've gotten yourself into the zero resources situation when nobody helps. And you were like, I was everything to everybody. I'm supporting a very big amount of families and friends and so on. And
that pressure.
Depression is impossible to describe.
Weighs on you over time.
Yeah. And when I say like, hey, I need help, I'm in a very, very bad situation. Nobody understands how that is. And, you know, my friends is here in California. I had a friend who is a girl. This is how you explain a girlfriend, which is not a girlfriend, right?
Right.
And she has her dog sick. And she was crying so very much, like, oh, I have so many big problems. My life is the worst. I'm like, what happened? She's like, my dog is sick. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the worst problems you really should cry about. This is the type of the calibration that you actually have within that. And that helps to suffer less. How do I stop the watch?
And also, I mean, you're also probably dealing with the fact that you've lost so many friends and family members because of the war as well.
Mm-hmm.
And also feeling in a way that makes you feel like almost on edge, wondering who's going to be next.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know that everybody's trying to be smiley. So this type of war is very different because there is internet connection, thanks to Starlink. Hello. There is Instagram available to the friends that are there, the front lines, and they're posting. They're smiling. They're like, hey, look at it. And they're sometimes, you know, they just stop posting. And you're like, is he okay? Is he just busy, quote unquote, or he's not?
And where did he go?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it happens every day. It happens every day.
Wow. So, but I mean, to counteract that, I mean, your side hustle, right? Your side company is developing developing and researching these bulletproof vests that is essentially, you know,
it was
saving lives.
It's not there anymore. It's not there anymore.
Oh, it's not there anymore.
No. It's not a business. I never wanted to have a war-related business, and it should have been done this way. So this is the bad thing about this overacting is that it's not sustainable at all, right? So for me, this experience was like for the first week, like I've said, everybody's overacting because they think that if you will act 200% of your possibilities, you can win now. Then second week, you become volunteering. You're helping everybody else who's still trying to act as much as possible. Third week or a month after, you're starting to get hungry. You understand that you lost your job. There's no money. There's no savings. Still, again, there's a bunch of volunteers helping out with everything. Food, houses, and everything. And then again, a week after that, you're done. And it's just a month has passed. You have to be strong for the war for whatever the time, years to come even. But a month has passed and you're done. You have nothing to eat. You have no motivation. You have no... And that explains how everything, including rescue operations, the research and centers, or whatever you want to do, needs to be sustainable. We started doing it properly. So we had this... Is it knit? When you knitting is their word, right? Mm-hmm. Knitting factory that did that thing for the t-shirt for the West, the hoodie for the West. I don't know how to call it. There's a proper word, but I know it in English, sadly. Yeah, it's not a hoodie, but yeah, whatever. It is an actual vest, right? So this is the word. Okay. I think this is the vest. But yeah, everybody doing this, we kind of gotten six of those factories under our wing. We created the technology for them to develop and create the vest to knit them. And they tried and wanted to work for free. And I said, this will not last long. Obviously, you're so into winning, like I've mentioned, right? So you want to win and you want to do as much as you can. And if you're a knit factory worker person. What's the word? There's a word. There should be a word for
knitter.
Ugh. kitten. Oh, knitten. So yeah, a knitter. then definitely you want to knit all your hands into vests, right? But no, this is not sustainable. In 3 days, they had, can we bring children to work? Because they have no nannies. They have nothing to, and we're scared. They don't have the childcare. Yeah, can we bring food to work? Can we? And I'm like, please stop not taking money. You have to. Because obviously for me, $2 an hour is okay. I can handle that. But for you, this is important. You need to feed your children. You need to live your life. And most of the quote unquote ventures of the war ended up being not sustainable. Everybody, you know, didn't want to start business. And I didn't want either. I don't want to have a war-related business in my life. I had to, and I dropped it.
I mean, it's a... Especially, it must be difficult for you to be able to be personally impacted as much as you have been impacted because of the war.
Yeah.
And it must be kind of difficult to be able to kind of wrestle with that. And I get it. I understand where you're coming from for sure.
Yeah, you know, the grade of how you suffer changed a lot. I thought that 10 out of 10... was very different, but now I understand that it is actually 50 out of 10. So,
right.
If my dog is hurt, I'm not going to suffer 10 out of 10 anymore at all.
Right.
That kind of makes you stronger. This is the saying, I think, right?
Yeah.
What doesn't kill?
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Yeah, and it didn't.
So, okay. So how, I mean, is there, going back to the LSD, uh-huh. right? So going back to the LSD, I mean, you know, here in the States, you know, I know that there's a lot of people that have, you know, experimented with that, you know, maybe.
It's illegal here. So I moved to Zoloft, which is one of the antidepressants, but right. I would say it's not very good.
Zoloft. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so and I'm currently under depression medication as well. I think I'm
which
on.
Like every second person.
Yeah. Escitalopram. And it has helped incredibly. But I feel like going down the LSD microdosing, you know, and having to make the, you know, having to actually physically make, you know, travel to Sweden to be able to get
Switzerland
to Switzerland to get help. I mean, that's a pretty drastic, you know, decision. I mean, you must have been kind of in a bad place. And also, how did it impact you? Right? Like, what were the main changes that you kind of felt to finally hear that music again?
It is a switch. I mean, weirdly, it happens next day, and you wanted to die for 3 months.
You feel different.
Next day you're getting better. I'm not saying that you're okay straight away,
right?
But you were at 0% of capabilities of living, and you went straight to 10%, and you're like, okay, probably it's worth something. So you regain your motivation a bit, because trying doing that actually was a huge force to stand up and go. It was, because I didn't want anything. And imagine how my life is way easier to survive compared to whomever else. I'm okay-ish. I have games. I have money. I have good cars. I have means of travel, which I didn't ever want to. I don't like traveling, as you probably get it already. And I was still in that place, in the worst. So I just forced myself to, just because one of my friends came and said, you, bad words, stop doing that, start doing good words. Right. And they actually just dragged me with my ears out of the bedroom, and they said, go and do that. And then I ended up in Cyprus in one of my friend's places, and that actually saved me, because it was together with the treatment I gotten from Switzerland and good looks of the ocean. It was just, he forced me to go to get breakfast with the view, and that unlocked some, I would say, self-saving mechanics that were off. They were out.
But it's also important to also recognize, right? It's also important to recognize that even though you have, you know, all these accolades, you've got all this money, you're able to support all these families, you've got the great cars, you've got the great watches, all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, somebody out there might not even recognize that deep down you're still you're struggling through.
Yeah,
through the process.
Because this is something that I was overcoming. I'm from a poor family, right? So this is I was overcoming that. I wanted to have everything, but when I finally gotten something, it's never everything. I'm not that rich. I'm compared to Ukraine, I'm okay, but
right, exactly.
But I am on a very start of trying to overcome all that. Is it complexes? There's a word.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a complex person, you're mm-hmm. trying to overcome them, right? So when you just start, when you get your first thousands of bucks, you're like, oh, I never needed that actually. So it's not related at all. The happiness is not related to money. And I once in a while, I was a poker player years ago, like most of professional gamers kind of tried out. And in poker, there's one of the rules saying that you need to get the money out of the room, of the poker room, right? To spend them and convince yourself that you're actually gaining goods from your work, play, or whatever. Because mm-hmm. most of the poker players, they tend to close out within the online poker playing thingy and just be happy about the balance they have. But you have to make yourself happy of other things.
Yeah, man. That's also the story of Vegas, right? You go there and you're like, I'm up. I no longer am up. I'm up. I've lost everything because I never took it out. Right.
Interestingly, it's not everything, you know. Yeah. So being mentally well and being happy is a very big, in-depth inner work, not related to money or anything. There's this pretty big longest, they say it's the longest ever research happening for years. I think it's Harvard or something, that was about happiness, how people have what they think mm-hmm. is the most important thing of being happy, and it is connectedness, it's community, what we did with Paul, right? Community engagement, community right. stuff. You have to be related. And my main mistake was I was so very into being related only to my work, which gave me the most happiness. And then I tried for years to unlock the I would say partnership, find the love.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard. The love hit me hard, sadly. But it's something worth mentioning, worth doing, because this is actually important. Finding love, not only probably with the only girl you love, finding love within family, friends. This connectedness is super important, and it is always better than the money or whatever, always. Mm-hmm. I've mentioned the event in Thailand that I've did before, right? And this costed me zero. This is part of my work. And I've never had this type of happiness, short term, obviously, happiness in my life ever. So this was one of the lifetime changing experiences. And I'm like, oh, I want to go and try them out all over. But when I don't know, first gotten into a Lamborghini, zero comparison to that. No fun.
Yeah.
Probably the first one probably will give you something. The second, third, never. And you don't even need it.
What was the event in Thailand?
It was called Garena Star League. It was the esports competition, and it attracted 30 times more people than we expected. That was the fun. Yeah. And I did host it. I did the on-stage experience.
Bring your own computer one, right?
No, that was DreamHack. It's different. DreamHack, it was in Sweden. In Thailand, it was a gaming competition. Everybody came to watch. So it was fans coming to watch. In Sweden, it's DreamHack when everybody brought their own computers to play together. And yeah, it's also an overwhelming experience. Definitely everybody should Google around DreamHack and just see the pictures. It's crazy, crazy, crazy thing that nobody ever thought that would happen. And one of the founders, Marcus is his name, he said that it was same for me with Garena. He thought that it was a bunch of friends coming over, but then there was hundreds of somebody's friends coming over, and it ended up being thousands. People bringing their own chairs, computers, and everything. So yeah, DreamHack is crazy again. And this is also something that costs you nothing and gives you so much.
It's that network. It's that personal connection.
The connection, the interconnection.
Well, and you know, that's I mean, to segue into it, man, like that's that right there is the primary reason why I wanted to start this podcast was because, you know, for my all my 20s, all of my 30s, I was so focused on trying to focus on the career, trying to make something out, you know, out of myself and stuff, and trying to, I guess, you know, change, you know, make my parents proud, like, you know, trying to, you know, on this journey of just pouring into my work, super long hours, not paying attention to family or friends and things like that. And I kind of wanted to re-pivot and have these conversations. What we're doing right now is connecting as men and talking about those vulnerable, because I mean, I fully believe that, you know, having taking down the guard as men and having those vulnerable conversations is what allows us to better understand each other. It allows us to learn from one another, and it allows us to just become better men.
I so want to be vulnerable. I so want to be. This is probably the largest outcome that I've had, that I'm going to be changing. I wanted to be so strong, and I wanted to help everyone all the time. I'm so welcoming. I'm always there for everybody. And I found out that nobody is there for me just because I positioned myself. So I do have friends, but nobody would ever invite me over because they thought that I am so big and rich and independent that I don't need it. And they were kind of shy of their households and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm like, everybody, for the first time, I think, in my life, that was the Cyprus friend of mine that invited me over, that helped me out, that I was willing to have that so very much. I don't need anything. I want to be a part of something that is not destroyed. I want to visit. So this UK program that gave residencies to Ukrainians, it actually was a sponsorship kind of thingy. So you people living in the UK were hosting Ukrainian families. And I never had the opportunity, so I wanted it so very much. I want everybody to host me. I don't need it financially. I need it mentally. I want to be a part of the community. I want to go with the flow, with where the flow is somebody else's flow, because I'm so very drained. And I can, obviously I can pay for everything. I can come with a Ferrari if you want, but I need that, and I never had that. And I never even given myself the ability to try it. And sadly, I still cannot unlock it. I want it so very much. Mm-hmm. So I want to live with somebody who lives a good life just to, you know, spend a couple of days or minutes or weeks or months. Yeah, I need it. And I never tried. I probably will.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's a great place to stop, man. I want you to know, okay?
Vulnerability is
good as men. And, you know, even though we're, you know, big burly guys, we got big hearts too, and that's all right.
Yeah, definitely.
I know. You're what, six?
2 meters. I'm 2 meters, which is, I don't know, 6'4"?
6'4", something like that.
I'm not very into...
Big burly beard, just so the audience can... Because I know this is audio only, so they can get a picture of you.
I think I have a picture on Ivan.gg on my website. I think I have
that. Yeah, there you go. There's the plug, right, for the website. Man, well, I want you to know, Ivan, you always got a friend here in Austin.
Yeah. When Ukraine opens up, everybody come. I do have a pretty big house, a lot of cars.
There you go.
Everybody, PlayStations. I do have a full computer club back at home. When five versus five can play each other any game. I do have it.
Party at Ivan's.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's win the war.
Thank you so much, Ivan. I appreciate your time.
Happy to be here.
And thank you so much for listening to the Learning Man podcast. My name is Omar Cantu. I could not thank you enough for joining me on this journey. If you enjoyed what you heard and would like some more of that content, we're going to be dropping new episodes every Friday. So make sure and hit that follow button wherever you listen to your podcast and write us a review, because it really does help the channel. Share what topic you want to tackle next, or maybe the name of a guest that you want to hear from. Thank you again for joining in this journey. It means so much to me.